Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Matthew Blitner. To my left, co-host Daniel Green. And in case you didn't catch our theme song, written by Jessica Page DeMary, whose full works are accessible online at jdcompositions.com, this is Outside the Studio. So for the next 57 minutes, please sit back, relax, and enjoy some hot and cold sports tapes. And we're very excited this week. We are starting off, we left you with a cliffhanger last week in which we were discussing the most exciting singular plays in professional sports. It was a debate. We got a lot of tapes on social media. We polled a lot of our loyal fans out there. Daniel, as a reminder, you said the most exciting play in sports is the inside the park home run in baseball. I said it was an overtime game-winning goal in the hockey playoffs during a multiple overtime period. Well, who knows if either of us are right? There's probably no right or wrong answer. We polled 18 of our loyal fans, and we're going to break it down for you sport by sport, and we're going to start with the sport that tied for first place with baseball. And for baseball, the number one thing that was chosen, Chris from Brooklyn said robbing a home run. It's a huge emotion swing from happiness to sadness, or sadness to happiness, depending on what side you're on. Daniel, don't over the wall for a home run. It definitely ranks up there.
It absolutely ranks up there. You see incredible athleticism, the way that players are climbing up the wall. You see somebody giving a great hit. You see somebody doing something on the offensive end that's unbelievable, just for it to be taken away and for it all to be for nothing. I love this answer. The one thing is, it's not as much necessarily in a high leverage situation. It depends on the game. It depends on the situation. For example, the Endy Chavez play, famously.
Oh boy, that one still stirs with fans all over the place.
It was one of the most amazing plays I've seen in sports history, but again, they didn't win the game. So it takes something away from that. So that's what I think a lot of these other answers have that maybe this one doesn't have, but it's still a great answer overall.
And to show, so again, out of this 18 fans, 6 of them chose a baseball-related play. Our special guest, occasional co-host Walt, said stealing home is his pit for the play. Danielle from Brooklyn said a grand slam home run, as did Sam in Lyndhurst, New Jersey. Rob from Brooklyn says a walk-off home run, as does Eddie from Brooklyn. So we've got some pretty exciting plays there in regards to what baseball can bring for an exciting play in a one-off. To our tied for last place is basketball. We're going to go in alphabetical order, ladies and gentlemen, in case you didn't realize that. Basketball only got 3 votes. Charlie, our loyal listener from Manhattan, chose a buzzer beater in the NCAA tournament by an underdog. Watching someone who possibly in their one moment of glory, as CBS likes to say, your one shining moment, Daniel, made the biggest play with a game on the line on the biggest stage in collegiate sports. Let's be honest. There's a reason why this song, One Shining Moment, is part of the synonymous part of the March Madness tournament.
Absolutely. And I can think of a lot of games in which a game was decided by a buzzer beater. But I actually want to counter that and say it's more dramatic when something happens like did in 2010, where Gordon Hayward missed the shot, where they were the underdog at Butler, and they missed the shot in the final minute.
Well, I guess there's a reason they're an underdog if they missed the shot.
I mean, he was a great player. He was a great college player. And the effort that they did against Duke, it was one of the most amazing games I've ever seen. And maybe I'm a little bit dark. I like seeing, hey, you came so close, and yet you came so far.
That is very dark indeed. I don't know if I feel comfortable sitting next to you here anymore. Chris from CBS also had a potential NCAA tie-in with a Hail Mary buzzer beater in basketball. I know the phrase Hail Mary is more football.
I'm thinking,
but
that's like a half-court shot, something like that. Yeah.
And Trevor in Chicago, Trev is a very loyal listener, says a very basic buzzer beater 3. Let's be honest, it's pretty exciting when the ball goes in and they have to first determine whether or not it actually counts. But, you know, that's the nature of the game. To our other tied for last place sport, football, I know it's the most popular sport in America. Sorry, football came in last again with 3 votes only. Anthony from Brooklyn said the most exciting play, and this one's out of the box, Dan. said when an extra point would send the team to overtime, but would conversely lose the game if they miss it. And again, he's talking about a two-point conversion. He's not talking about a standard kick. He's talking about the two-point conversion after a touchdown when a conversion wins you the game, but if you miss, you're losing the game. And look, that's an out there one, definitely out of the box. There's a lot of drama involved in that type of decision.
All I can think of is think of my time when I was at Michigan and I visited a good friend and watched Ohio State versus Michigan, and a play came down to something like this in the biggest rivalry in college football, and Michigan went for two when they could have played for overtime. We love seeing this because it's gambling. It's exciting.
Are we sure Riverboat Ron didn't create this decision in the first place?
And Riverboat Ron actually did that this year, and it almost cost the Washington football team the division. And
It should have.
I mean, if the Giants were at all competent. But the point is, this is a very exciting play. I don't like it when I'm on the fan side. I usually think, come on, just play for overtime. But I love seeing it. It is gambling. It is exciting. It does add to the drama of the sport.
Well, the other football response is we have Rob from Long Island saying a game-winning touchdown in the final seconds. I guess we can call that the leap and a prayer play, the Hail Mary type play. Or maybe they're running it in, who knows. And Mike in Brooklyn said a pit sits because of those sheer momentum swing. I mean, pit sits has happened a lot.
Think of the James Harrison one in the Super Bowl and how that's a different game. That completely changed the game. They're on the goal line, the Cardinals, and if Warner doesn't throw that pick, it's possible that the Cardinals win their
first. How about the Russell Wilson, Malcolm Butler one?
That wasn't pick six, but yeah, same idea. Same idea. Completely changed the fortune.
And now to our tied for first. It actually surprised us that this sport tied for first, and that's hockey with six to match baseball, six votes. Leo from Staten Island says a game-winning goal in overtime in hockey. He said, I want to say home run, which would have broken the tie and given baseball the win here, but when you're on offense as a fan, you rest a little easier. And if you're the road team, it's exciting, but you still have to pitch the bottom of the inning. Whereas an overtime winner in hockey is boom, over, done, win or lose, that's it, game over, and then that's got to be the best way to say that.
Matt, as you will soon defend your position on agreeing with this, I think this is as good an argument as any. This is as cogent as any. Any mistake, any error that happens, there's no margin for error, especially in the playoffs, especially when there's no points. There's nothing that you could do. You have to win the game. That's how it has to happen. And
it's the only sudden death in sports.
And he nails it with baseball. With baseball, yes, you don't get the home run, or you do get the home run. Well, it's not necessarily that the game is over one way or the other. But in terms of hockey, yeah, this is a great argument for it.
And look, our other votes for hockey, Summer from Long Island says an empty net goal scored by the opposing goalie. That's a rare one.
Brodeur did it a couple.
But you know, that's quite a while ago. We had one last year. I believe it was Pecorine who had one, first one in about 5 years. Tanya from Queens gave the same answer. So, you know, definitely something to dissect there. Tara from Brooklyn says a power play goal. She might be referencing Sam Rosen's "It's a Power Play Goal" call there. Seth from Brooklyn says Game 7, Stanley Cup Final, overtime, game-winning goal. I mean, it doesn't get much more final than that, Dan. And Jason from Brooklyn said a game-winning overtime goal in hockey. So it's sudden death, so teams need to execute perfectly. And look, I know that you had your fun with the inside the park home run, and I'll admit it's an exciting play, but an overtime goal in hockey seems to be outnumbering you here last count about 4-1.
And that makes sense, but here's what they're not factoring in. With an inside-the-park home run, as I said last week, it's one of the most amazing plays in sports because it's so dramatic. It's a guy going at 110%, rounding the bases as fast as he can. But there's one thing that none of these other plays have that this has, and that is comedy. Because in order to have an inside-the-park home run, you need a cavalcade of errors, and I like to laugh a little bit. I like the miscues in the outfield combined with someone going 110%. So I keep my answer despite all of these cogent arguments that we've heard before.
And look, I I think your answer is fine, but they say hockey is the greatest sport to watch live, and especially playoff hockey. And I know I'm, you know, it wasn't only the overtime goals. A lot of people chose the overtime goal in the playoffs. This is just the absolute, the emotion that you see in the players, that you see in the fans, in the announcers' calls, just puts it all together. You have an inside-the-park home run, like where Michael A. Taylor screwed up in the outfield and ended up letting the ball trickle through him on what should have been a single. The official scorer ended up ruling it on inside-the-park home run. That there's a lot of discretion there.
But there's
no discretion in a game-winning overtime goal in hockey.
What is more entertaining than laughter? What is more entertaining than watching an outfielder bobble the ball and make a bunch of miscues? This is like the Three Stooges, but in sports. Come on.
Well, how about this? And I'm going to end our argument with this. You can say comedy is great and laughter is great. How about sending 18,000 to 20,000 fans home happy plus another, let's say, 500,000 to 1,000,000 on TV watching? I take you right back to Derek Stepan, Game 7, 2015, second round, Rangers versus the Washington Capitals. Rangers had been down 3-1 in the series. They came back to force a Game 7. They go to overtime in Game 7 at the world's most famous arena. Doc Emmerich on the call, and you know Doc is not a Ranger fan, and Derek Stepan scores from the left faceoff circle to win the game and the series. The fans were banging. I thought the glass was going to break. The plexiglass around the rink was going to break. That's how exciting it was.
And as exciting as that was, though, is it the best medicine? No, but laughter is the best medicine.
Okay.
And that's why it's inside the park home runs.
Okay, how about this, for just to sum it up, I can't let you get the last word here. Without a game-winning overtime goal in hockey playoffs, we don't have this show right here, because I became a hockey fan because of Marion Gilbert's triple overtime winner, and that led me on the path to becoming a media person. Without that, we don't have a show, so you're null and void on that point. Ladies and gentlemen, you can weigh in, reach out to us on any form of social media if you want to continue the debate. We're going to move right now into a recorded interview with famed New York Yankee reporter from WFAN, Sweeney Murdy, that we recorded the other day. We would like to add in well wishes to Aaron Boone, who had pacemaker surgery on Wednesday. He had open heart surgery back in 2009. He already feels back, like he's back to normal and that he can and come back any day. But please bear in mind that the interview was recorded before Boone's surgery. So what we asked Murdy about in regards to Boone obviously is a little bit outdated. But the rest of it, please make sure to pay attention to, as Murdy did give a lot of great answers.
Sweeney Murdy obviously is somebody who we've respected for a long time. He's been covering the Yankees for a long time. He's the consummate professional, and nobody has more insight to this team than him.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. It's Outside the Studio, your host, Matthew Blittner, joined here today by longtime Yankee reporter, Sweeney Murdy. Sweeney, thank you so much for joining us here. Talk to us a little bit. You know, it's been in the news a lot. Domingo Ramon, this is a situation that's gone on for a year and a half, almost 2 years now. Do you see this being a chemistry problem going forward for the team this year, and how long or short is his leash?
Well, there's no easy answer to all of that. I think what happens a lot of times when you think about when a player gets involved in a scandal, he apologizes for the scandal, he gets a chance to move on starting from that day, it's kind of a yes and no for Domingo Ramon on that, because there are clearly teammates inside that clubhouse that have taken exception, and you know they're the ones who have kind of described how long the leash is. When you think about Luke Voit saying he's skating on thin ice, I think it's up to Herman to just kind of keep his head down and do what he's supposed to do, both on and off the field. He needs to pitch well to make this team and to have an impact on this team, and that will determine a lot of where he fits in here. But it's pretty clear that that there are players in the Yankees who witnessed what happened. Their wives have become involved in the situation. and it's not an easy situation for anybody. So to think that a press conference where you say, I'm sorry and apologize to teammates in a meeting, to think that you can just wipe it away, that's a little naive. This is something that's going to be kind of ongoing for him.
And look, this is something that you touched on it. You know, he needs to pitch well. There have been multiple radio shows who have brought up this situation. Let's say he gets off to a middling start. We're not going to give him a Cy Young type start. We're not going to give him a banishment to the bullpen start. He gets off to a middling. He goes 2-1 in his first four with an ERA in the mid to high fours. Is that enough to secure his spot, or do you see this potentially being where, look, if he rattles off four bad games in a row or something like that, he's going to lose his roster spot, and this is going to be just, you know, part of the reason why to get rid of him?
Well, I mean, the performance is going to dictate that part. They're going to be, you know, anywhere, as Aaron Boone has talked about, he's excited about the potential of, you know, 8, 10, 12 different people here who could start games. And that's going to be something that the Yankees are going to have to rely on. So, you know, even good performance is going to force some guys to take some time out of the rotation to preserve them for the long season. But, I mean, you're asking me about hypothetical, you know, 4 or 5 game starts for Herman. You really just have to see it play out and see what's available. See, you know, is everybody healthy? Is somebody else pitching well? There's not an easy, you know, take this guy out and plug him in computer program solution. There are a lot of other factors working there.
It's definitely not an easy situation, and it's only going to get probably more difficult as these questions potentially become real situations. You've mentioned Aaron Boone, and look, there's been questions from different parts of the fan base over the last couple of years about him, the way he uses his bullpen, the way he deploys his pitchers. Look, there's no doubting that they've been a successful team. In the full season, they've averaged just over 100 wins. There's something to be said for that. But at the same time, there's got to be a reason why this team, with the talent that it has, and with anyone from the top down in the organization saying that this is the most talented roster they've had in years, every year saying that, what does Aaron Boone need to do from a managerial perspective to finally get them over that hump this year? And if he doesn't, are we potentially discussing a new Yankee manager next year?
I don't think there is going to be enough reason to change managers if it's a team that gets to the playoffs and loses. You know, Brian Cashman has made very clear that he likes Aaron Boone in this role, would like to see him here for a number of years. And as long as he's still the one picking the manager, I don't see that there's anything really to change about that. I don't know if there's anything he can do differently. Sometimes you just need different results. And that's not anything that you can directly control as the manager sometimes, you know. The Yankees lost Game 5 last year to the Rays by one run. They had a situation, a fifth, sixth inning, where they had, you know, guys on base, and one hit could have changed, a single could have changed the course of that game, where you bring in different relievers and you end up, you know, winning Game 5 and moving on. That's not a whole lot. You know, the guy in the batter's box has to do that. So there's really not a lot for Aaron Boone here. You know, this is a matter of the team staying healthy and performing to expectations.
In terms of staying healthy, and it's going to be critical for their starting rotation, which of course will then lead to the bullpen usage that we just talked about. Corey Kluber and Jameson Taillon, they haven't been that healthy over the last couple of years. Now, look, players get hurt. We understand that. And in Taillon's case, of course, you know, he had more than injuries. He also had cancer a few years ago, and, you know, just for him to have come back is fantastic in that regard. What is this, a Garrett Cole and Pray for Rain type of situation taking off of the late 50s Braves or and Rudes, or is this something that, you know, the Yankees can reasonably expect their rotation to be a strength? Because beyond Cole, if Kluber and Taillon don't stay healthy, well, who are you plugging in?
Yeah, I think the Yankees aren't alone in this kind of situation where you're talking about trying to get from a 60-game season back to a 162-game season. There aren't a lot of pitchers in baseball who can go out there this year and make 32 starts and throw 200 innings. I don't think, unless your name is Cole or DeGrom, there are very few other people here that can think about doing that. So the Yankees have built a rotation that has a lot of depth to it, and I'm thinking if you think about guys like Kluber and Taillon especially, you know, it's not about thinking, can they stay healthy to make 32 starts? It's, can you get 15, 20, 25? And do you have other guys to fill in the rest of that? And I think that's how they've built this staff, with the idea and the expectation that you're going to have to drop guys in here to give extra rest, or you know, pull somebody out for a turn to give them rest. It's kind of a moving thing for every team, and I think that's part of the reason the Yankees bet on the high side of expectations for Tyone and Kluber, which, you know, could be 20 really good starts because nobody's giving you 32.
And in regards to no one giving 32 outside of maybe, as you mentioned, maybe two or three pitchers in the entire game, is there, assuming that, you know, Cole's your one, Kluber and Tyone, some, you know, order are your two and three, I'm going to have to guess that Montgomery is your four, at least for right now. Is there any possibility of fitting Davey Garcia, Michael King, and who knows, in sort of like a piggybacking situation for that fifth starter spot, where maybe you get one of them to go four innings or five innings, and then you bring in the other, and then the next week you flip it?
I think you have a lot of different options available to you. I don't think that that's necessarily a season-long solution. You know, a lot of things are going to change along the way. You know, Aaron Boone talked about having maybe the first month of this kind of scripted out, but you know, you get two rainouts or two injuries in the first week of the season, and everything changes. So, what you're you can describe a lot of different scenarios, and they could all happen at some point during the year. It's hard to say this is how you're going to do it every single time. You know, and again, performance will be part of this too. Injury will be part of this, and you kind of have to have a lot of different options available to you, which is why I think they've built this the way that they have.
That's a great analysis of their rotation. Moving from their pitchers, though, into the everyday players, not that, of course, you know, there's obviously going to be a pitcher on the mound every game, but for the outfielders, the infielders, Aaron Judge, it's obviously not a huge concern yet. He still has another, I believe it's 2 years left before he hits free agency, so there's still time. What do you see off of what we know for Judge right now, which is that when he's healthy, he's one of the better players in the game? What do you see as possible parameters for either an extension, should he choose to sign one before getting to free agency, or once he does get to free agency, what the ballpark might be for a potential deal for him?
Well, I don't think they're going to sign into an extension because, you know, there's 2 years left and he has to prove he's healthy for those 2 years. It's not in his best interest to sign an extension right now. He's got to go out there and prove he's worth as much money as he can get. And I think, you know, you're just going to have to wait to see how this plays to see if he can stay healthy for this season. And he's had, you know, a couple of, you know, seasons cut short here, obviously. 18, 19, 20 have not been 17. As far as number of games played and the production that he's put up, it's really hard to say where he's going to be because a lot of it just depends on how he gets through. And it's, you know, it's not going to be, you know, in the mega $300 million Harper, Machado, you know, Trout, Tatis kinds of deals. He's, you know, he's going to be older than any of those players when he signs this deal. So that is going to cut into a big thing of it. So I think it's really hard to think about what he's going to get until you see how he springboards into this. You know, it's not fair to anybody to try to project a salary number based off of a season that is now 4 years ago and say, okay, if he's healthy, he hits that, he's got to get out there and do it.
And look, it's obviously a situation that, as we alluded to, it's not going to be something where we're going to have any resolution, not that a resolution is needed, but we're not going to have any answers to this for a couple of years. At which time in the middle of that is a very contentious collective bargaining agreement talk with Major League Baseball and the Players Association. Obviously, that's not just a Yankees issue. That's a league-wide issue. Do you foresee, in your gut, having covered this sport for as long as you have, do you see the two sides ending up in a lockout, whether it be a short or long term, doesn't matter, but do you see them going into a lockout, or do you see them avoiding it altogether?
Yeah, it's really hard to say. I mean, there are so many issues here, and as you touched on, there are a number of years of just bad blood between these guys. So the idea of coming to an agreement quickly doesn't seem like it can happen. But a lot of that will be determined over the course of these next few months here. You know, we're still a long way from December, and you know, I think it's just really hard to figure. It's hard to think it's going to get better between now and then, you know, to the point where there is a quick resolution to this. But I think we have to get a little bit closer to that part of it, to the deadline, before we see how ugly this really gets.
Nothing like a deadline to spur action, as I always say on that. Back to the Yankees right now. They're projected by most of the Sabermetric and FanGraph and most sites to win the division, if not to win at least the entire American League before facing the NL champ in the World Series. In your opinion, who are the biggest threats to them, both in their division and in the American League, that could potentially be a roadblock to that World Series appearance?
Yeah, the division is interesting. I think that Tampa Bay is still somebody to really look at because, you know, it scares me when they give away pitchers or affordable pitchers, you know, when Snell is actually still affordable and they decide to move on, when there are other affordable pitchers out there, you know, they know something the rest of us don't. They've kind of proven that. So I won't count them out until you see that. Toronto is an interesting team because of all their firepower and their young stars. But you know, what they didn't have last year was the ability to, you know, play a full season and see how they responded in the final month. See what a long summer and a pennant race can do, and physically and mentally, the pressure that they build and what you have to do to get through that last season. The Yankees are full of players who've done that, who played a full season and played into October and kind of know what it takes to get from point A to point B. I feel like Toronto just kind of has to do that. Not saying they can't, but, you know, they haven't yet, so that's something that you want to kind of wait to see. But they obviously have the talent. They invested in some pitching. That's a team that you really want to kind of see and see how what kind of start they get off to, and what kind of, you know, they have injuries that they have to deal with, and how they kind of get through the season. Those are a couple of pretty good teams right there, I think, you know, to see how they get through a full season.
Are there teams aside from the AL East rivals of the Yankees that you see being a stumbling block, or is it pretty much the AL East is their main stumbling point, if it even exists?
I mean, the Yankees are going to be the team to beat in this league. I think that everybody kind of looks at them that way. If they make the postseason, there's a potential stumbling block everywhere. You know, the other teams are going to be good. You get to a postseason, you get one bad start or another team that's a big hit in the seventh inning, it changes things around. I don't want to sit there and tell you that, you know, just because the Yankees are a favorite in the American League, that, everybody else, that it's a cakewalk when they get to the postseason. I don't think that's an accurate picture. I just feel like it's, you know, this is a long road, and the first step is just getting to the postseason, and that's what the Yankees have to accomplish first.
Thank you so much. And ladies and gentlemen, if you're just tuning in, we've been talking with Sweeney Murdy here about the New York Yankees prospects for this year. Sweeney, before we let you go, cards on the table. If you had to pick right now, you're in a Las Vegas casino, or you're just talking with some friends, and you have to pick, where are the Yankees finishing this year? Are they winning the World Series? Are they bowing out in the AL? You know, where is this team going? You know, is it Division Series, Championship Series, Wild Card? What is this team's finish that you foresee?
It's almost the same thing every year. They're a really good team that has a chance to win it all. I can't predict what's going to happen down the road. It's just, you know, they have some good players. They have some really good players. They have a couple of question marks. They're as good as any team, maybe better than most of them. So we'll see if that actually ends in a championship. It's not unlike many other seasons that we've seen where you kind of think one thing and you kind of wait to see how it plays out. But if you're talking about being in a Las Vegas casino, I'm walking out, putting my money back in my pocket because that's the safest place for it.
It's a great answer right there. Again, Sweeney, thank you so much for joining us here on Outside the Studio. And we will hopefully be speaking to you again at some point when we know more with the Yankees as the season progresses, and maybe we'll even be riding down that parade in the Canyon of Heroes.
Well, I just want to let you know, parades go up the Canyon of Heroes. It's a little pet peeve of mine. They don't go down, they go up. City Hall, Battery Park to City Hall is straight north. So when you hear people say down the Canyon of Heroes, that is the wrong direction, my friend. You want your parades to go up the Canyon of Heroes.
Fair point. You got me there. Sweeney 1, Outside the Studio 0.
Thanks, Matthew.
You're welcome. All right. Have a great day.
All right. Have a good one.
You too.
Ladies and gentlemen, we just had the enormous privilege of hearing from Sweeney Murdy, longtime beat writer for the New York Yankees, and it was quite informative. I mean, I understand his skepticism. I mean, the Yankees haven't won in 11 years, and I understand him hedging his bets and saying to himself, I don't want to pick it, but this team is as good as any, and always somebody who is a pleasure to listen to, and I'm glad that we all got the opportunity to do that. Now, we're moving on a little bit to a little bit of NBA news. And it's an interesting time because it's the All-Star Weekend. It's a time where there's a lot of celebrations. If you can remember last year's All-Star Weekend, you can think about all the hope, all of the excitement going into the All-Star Week. But this is a little bit of a different story.
It really is. Look, Daniel, you and I have had the opportunity when we were younger to fly into the same places as the NBA All-Stars in the airports and get to meet a number of them about 10, 12 years ago. The players really look forward to this. Their families look forward to this. The fans look forward to this. It's not that taste this year. LeBron James himself has come out and questioned why they're having the All-Star game.
And the reason is ultimately, it's about money and it's about fan engagement, but is this the right time to do this? It seems like it's not. A lot of the players have come out and basically said if there weren't these enormous fines for not playing in it, they wouldn't want to participate. And I don't blame them. It's just a weird year to have this, and it's going to be a weird All-Star game. And there is still something exciting about it, though. It's still seeing the best of the best. They are raising money for historically black colleges and universities, but
I mean, there's better ways to raise the money.
And I think that's the point that a lot of the players are making, is that this was a little bit of a slap in the face towards the players.
And look, they can reformat it however the league wants. Last year, of course, they did a tribute to Kobe Bryant, who had recently passed away. This is not going to be your father's NBA All-Star game or your grandfather's NBA All-Star game. You had Kevin Durant and LeBron James draft their teams from a pool of selected All-Stars. It's not like they just pit their friends from around the league. Although, to be fair, most of the All-Stars are probably friends with each other. And Kevin Durant selected, among the others, James Harden, Kyrie Irving, two Brooklyn Nets teammates, as well as a nice ode to the New York-Brooklyn rivalry. He picked Nick Julius Randle to be with him. So that was a nice little thing that he did. Their team is a lot deeper than LeBron's team. LeBron has Giannis. Yeah, it's Steph Curry, but it gets a little thin after that.
No, I mean, he still has Luka. They're still going. I mean, it's obviously, it's the All-Star game.
I mean, Joel Embiid is on Durant's team as well. Just saying about that.
Ultimately, the team Durant, I predict, should take down this game, despite the fact that Giannis and LeBron are possibly the two best players in the game, maybe outside of Joel Embiid, the way he's playing this season. But This is going to be a fun matchup. You're going to see also a lot of chemistry. That's ultimately why I think Team Durant is going to win. You're going to have Harden and Kyrie, and you're going to have a little bit of that teammate bond that's going to help them push over the top.
And beyond the All-Star game, of course, they still have the dunk contest, three-point shooting. They have the skills competitions. And I'm a little curious as to why Obi Toppin, who, he's very far from an All-Star. Maybe in a couple of years he'll be a bona fide All-Star with the Knicks. They certainly hope so, having picked him, I believe it was 8th overall this past draft. Why is he in the dunk contest?
I'm just hoping this is the spark that he needs. We've seen a lot of people come and use the slam dunk contest as their entry point. You look at Vince Carter in 2000. He wasn't necessarily the greatest player before that. You look at Michael.
He was still deserving to be there, though.
I mean, Michael Jordan was obviously a sensation, but what really pushed him, part of what really pushed him was that dunk contest. So hopefully this boosts Obi Toppin's confidence, but no, he has not played like an all-star this year and really has, and it's a rookie year and it's hard to know, but for somebody who was supposed to be ready to perform at a high level, he has been somewhat disappointing.
I mean, I guess for Knicks fans, it's nice. For Nets fans, it's nice. They have, I believe it's 5 total players between Durant, Kyrie, Harding, Randall, and Toppin at the All-Star festivity. So there will be a uniquely New York, Brooklyn flavor to the proceedings. So make sure to check that out if that is something that you find interesting. We're going to currently get to something a little bit more pressing in the New York sports scene, and that is the other day, Jets GM Joe Douglas did a bit of a 180, Daniel. He said, after a long time of saying, you know, they didn't know if they would take calls on Sam Darnold, that they will now, on Wednesday, said they will now take calls from opposing general managers on the availability and potential trade of Sam Darnold. No one expected Darnold to suit back up for the Jets this year with the number 2 pick available to them and either Justin Fields or Zach Wilson sitting there for them to draft. But there was at least some speculation that they could use that pick and others to put weapons around Darnold. The fact that Darnold, that they're now willingly taking calls on Darnold openly, forget about what was going on behind the scenes, because I'm sure they were taking calls. But now that they are openly admitting to it, Sam Darnold has played his last snap in a gangrene uniform, and you can take that to the bank.
I actually disagree. I think it's hard to know. Shocker. It's hard to know what has happened with Sam Darnold. If you look at this offseason, the amount of QB instability is unheard of. We talked about it on the show. It's an unbelievable carousel going on. So is this Sam Darnold story real? Is it a situation where they're trying to generate interest in him? I've said that I think that they should work on building the team. You'd really have to be impressed from Zach Wilson or Justin Fields. It's really hard to say we want Sam Darnold to leave with one of these guys when you have no weapons around whoever's going to play quarterback.
It's a great point, and look, we're going to see what's going to happen. The draft is less than 2 months away now. We're going to move into a live interview that we have with the number one table hockey player in Carlo Bacio, King Carlo, as he likes to be referred to. But before we get Carlo on the phone, we would like to extend our condolences to the family, to the Gretzky family. Wayne Gretzky's father, Walter Gretzky, passed away last night at the age of 82. He had been battling Parkinson's and several other medical problems over the last few years. He was a quintessential hockey dad in Canada, probably just as famous as his son, one of the nicest people you'll ever meet from all the testimonials, and it's a huge loss for the hockey community. It really is.
He's an unbelievable person, and he's somebody, quintessential hockey dad is absolutely right. He's somebody who, there's a famous Wayne Gretzky quote that's always surrounding him, is he went to where the puck was going. He wasn't where the puck had been, and he learned that from his dad. His dad was somebody who helped him lace up his skates at a young age, somebody who helped coach him, somebody who supported him, and this is a good time to, you know, give a shout out to all the parents that really make all of the athletes that we discuss possible. Wayne Gretzky wouldn't be who he is without Walter Gretzky, and losing him is a big loss. It's a big loss, and hopefully we wish everything but the best for the Gretzky family at this time. And yeah, I'm saddened by this news.
Ladies and gentlemen, again, it is a very sad situation for the Gretzky family, again, please, the Gretzky family, know that you're in our thoughts and you're in our prayers, Wayne and his sisters. We are now going to be joined by Table Hockey King, King Carlo. Carlo, can you hear us? It's Matt and Dan and outside the studio.
Yes, I can hear you very well. Hi, guys. How's it going?
We're doing well, King, and we're excited to talk to you today. We've just started playing table hockey. Matt and I have a little bit of a rivalry going, and we need the best. We need the best to give his opinions.
So before we
all right, that's what I'm here for.
But before we get into what makes you the king, let's start with how you became a table hockey player, because you have to learn to walk before you can run. So give it to us straight, King. Why did you start playing table hockey?
It's very easy. In the household, I had an older brother. So when he was maybe 9, I was 4, because we have 5 years difference. So he started playing hockey. My dad loved hockey, so he initiated me. And I used to get a royal beating all the time. I mean, at that age, the age difference is wild, right? So I used to play with my brother all the time. We used to have the NHL schedule every night. We used to play 5-6. You know how I did. Once you start playing table hockey, you say you'll play one game. 2 hours later, you're still playing. So I started with him.
Well, that's great. And, I mean, it's great that you were able to play so many games and saying that, you know, playing one game and then 2 hours later, you're still playing game 5 or 6. For Daniel and I, it's more like 2 hours later, we're still stuck in the first game because there's no scoring going on.
Well, you're going to need courses. That's what I'm here for.
Yeah, we played the other night. It took us about 45 minutes to get 2 goals. Daniel won 2-0. I'm still salty over that.
So what is your...
Okay. You're going to need help.
What's your key to honing your skills? Like, how did you become the player that you've become?
Well, okay, well, like I said, with my brother, it was a lot of help. Hey? We brought ourselves up. I used to beat him, like, I used to lose for the first 5-10 years of my life, so, and then I got fed up of losing, right? So and I don't even like to use that word, so I'll stop using it. I was not winning often. There you go. So every time I used to practice with him, I used to get better. He used to get better. And the first league I joined was back in 1990, actually. I was 18 years old. And then when I walked in a room was full of table hockey games and everybody was there, different styles. I mean, it was crazy. So every time I used to get it scored a goal on, I used to try to examine how he was placing the puck, what plays he was using. I used to go back home and practice them. Because in my head, I said, if he's good, if he's able to score on me like that, I'll learn his plays. So eventually, I learned everybody's strong plays, and I made up some of my own. And then you use your creativity and whatnot, and just the competitive edge, you know? And we're lucky enough here in Montreal, Canada, to have a whole bunch of strong players. So once you're always playing with the best, you got no choice but to come better and better and better. And you strive for greatness, if you will. You know, it's all about having fun, but you want to be the best that you could be. And it's a competitive edge, I guess.
King, you talked about it as if it's, you know, real players on the ice in the NHL being able to dissect video of their opponents and everything. Look, not to say that there isn't video, because you can go on YouTube and there's plenty of table hockey videos, but you're taking this really, really seriously, and I mean, good for you on that, but how is it that you're really talking about this at a level that you would almost equate it to a grandmaster in chess? So, take us through this.
Yeah, well, the thing is, we started an organization, okay, the National Table Hockey League, NTHL.ca, I guess you guys seen it, and with John Fayol, and then a whole bunch of people grew into it, and we have tournaments in Detroit, Chicago, Toronto, Montreal, so all the best players come out. We have day tournaments. Each game is 5 minutes, right? So as you're playing, you actually are playing with the best players in the world. So people that never seen table hockey don't understand it, but for the people that actually experience the tournament and you see the level of competition and the plays that are being done and the sheer speed of it, it's like real hockey, but you're controlling all 5 men. There's no super magic button. You have to make the plays depending on how you hold the rods, how you place your players. You could do short side goals, far side goals, top corners. You could play the box defense. You could play a fast game, a slow game. It's the best miniaturized game of the real sport. NHL is the hockey game. NTHL is the national table hockey game. It's the same sport as real hockey. You have to experience a tournament to understand it. You guys have been lucky enough, I think, to see it. So I'm curious to see, how do you think it is? You think it's serious or just a joke?
No, it's definitely not a joke. We love it. I mean, we're big fans. That's why we wanted to have you on the show. And what we would ask from you, though, is what would you say are some good tips for newer players, people trying to get into the game and really improve what they're able to do?
So let's be honest. We need as much help as we can get.
Yeah, well, when you got like experienced players helping you, that would help, you know, to give tips. But I mean, the sure of it is, have fun with it. And if you watch video, I know John was working on actually making videos to show the plays in slow motion and teach the newcomer. Hopefully that project will come to light where people could go on the internet and see what a low tip is, see what a high tip is, see what a wraparound is, see what all the different plays that we use, and trick shots and not so trick shots. So people could see them on video and practice them at home and say, oh, that's how he does it. That's how he does it. So then practice makes perfect. But at the speed that we go, if you don't teach the people, like in the slow motion, what exactly the plays it is and how to do it, you'll never learn and have the full experience of the game. So that's what actually John is trying to do. And I know Kenny and I filmed videos for him. So if you watch videos of how to make plays, then you'll understand it. And maybe, you know, you'll improve. Well, not maybe, you'll improve for sure.
Well, I'm going to be a little skeptical that Daniel and I can improve, but definitely other people can improve in this. We want to talk to you. You keep mentioning John, who, of course, is John Fayol. He's the founder of Soho Table Hockey. You, a couple years ago, I believe it was the summer of 2019, won the TJ Rudd Cup 50th anniversary tournament held by Soho Table Hockey. And you routinely, as you've alluded to, compete in other tournaments and stuff like that. The quality of play, and look, it's one thing to be very good at something and to enjoy the fact that you're really good at it, but there has to be something more that keeps you coming back, right? It can't just be that, you know, what keeps you motivated, because after a while, you have to figure complacency would set in.
Yeah, well, yeah, I understand what you're saying, but the thing is, it's a sport because, listen, at the level we play it at, yes, it's a game for many, but at the level where we play it, I'm not even afraid of calling it a sport, because at the end of the day, if you have competition with the top players and you see what it is, you're completely exhausted mentally and physically. Sure, you don't get hit and whatnot, but I mean, the level of concentration that you need, you can't even blink or else you'll get scored 2-3 goals, right? So, but the fun of it is, as you get older and with experience, you could actually compete with the young people. I mean, I'm closing in on 50 and I'm still beating the kids of 20, 30, 40 years old, right? So it's in the head. For me, it's a challenge. I want to outsmart my opponent. If you beat me, it's in my head as I did something wrong. So try to change it, try to figure it out. And who doesn't like to, yes, you like to win. You don't like not to win. And you can't win them all, but the challenge is, I want to outdo myself, and I want to leave it all out on the table. And if I don't win that day, fine, I'll take it again against you, and everybody's the same way. Oh, Carlo, I'm going to beat you next time. Well, that's what I want to hear. And then another guy, Carlo, I'm going to beat you next time. And sometimes they beat me, and sometimes they don't. But fortunately for me, because I like winning, I think I have a 75% average on tournaments. I've won like 50 or 60 tournaments. I lost count. And that might seem arrogant, but I swear to you, there's a fine line between arrogance and confident, and I prefer to say that I'm confident.
And King, we respect that persona. We respect that drive to win. And one of the other things we respect is your King persona. Now, yours truly, I'm trying to get a cool nickname. That's one of the things that I've been working on.
It's not going to happen.
It's one of the things I'm working on this show. But in terms of the King persona, how did that come about, and why do you keep it?
Okay, well, the King persona, at the beginning when I used to start the tournaments on the circuit, we started in 2005, so we used to go to Quebec and Montreal and Sherbrooke, and at one point I was pretty much winning them all, right? So there's this gentleman that started hosting tournaments in 2000, his name is Bert Brossard, he's from Quebec City. So at one point he just came out, nobody's going to beat King Carlo, nobody could beat King Carlo, King Carlo's always winning. So he gave me that name, so then people started using it, King Carlo, and I said, you know what, it sounds pretty cool, fine, I'll use it. And then I used to go do like little table hockey seminars at hockey schools where I used to bring games, and the kids used to run out of the locker rooms to come and play upstairs, right? Because that was like their like hockey schools, right? And so I said, let me buy a crown and a cape. I made myself a cape, and you know, kids, they like a little show, right? So they all want to wear the crown, and when they scored a goal against King Carlo, I used to make them wear a crown. So it kind of stuck. And I said, you know what? It's kind of fun. And some people probably find it show off, some like showboating or whatever, but it's all in great fun and to promote the sport. And, you know, I'm a big kid. That's what I am. I like to have fun.
That's a great answer. And, you know, to see you, and I've had the opportunity to see you in the King Crown and everything, it's a sight to behold. I have to say, it really does feel like the majesty there. Before we let you go, and ladies and gentlemen, in case you're just tuning in, we've been talking with the king of table hockey, King Tarlo. Tarlo, what is it about the Soho table hockey tables that you play on so much that compares or doesn't compare to other tables? You know, just compare them for us in terms of the quality and why you like playing on those so much.
Yeah, there's two types that he does. There's a small S slot and there's a bigger game, the Soho Pro, the one that we had the big tournament on. I mean, the quality of rods, the quality of the ice surface, the sheer toughness and durability of the game. There's no other games that compare on the market, I believe. It's not fair to the other ones. There's a couple more other games, I'm sure, but I mean, his games are great. They're great to play on. It's good ice. So if you put in my condolences to the Gretzky family, what a day to actually be talking about this. My favorite player of all time, right? But I mean, when Wayne used to play at Edmonton on the good ice, he could make all his passes and his plays. If you put Wayne Gretzky on a pond, well, he can't make all the great plays that he could. Well, if you put a non-great player on a pond or on the great ice, it makes less difference because he won't be able to do the Wayne Gretzky plays. Well, it's the same thing with table hockey. If you got good ice surface, good rods, and good all around, equilibre in French. You know, if you don't have the right balance, you can't make all your plays. And on the Soho games, what John did with the quality of the games, it's phenomenal. It really is phenomenal to play on.
Oh, thank you for that, Tarlo, and I'm sure John Fayol and Soho Table Hockey are glad for the endorsement from none other than the king, because the king rules his kingdom after all. So we're going to let you go here, and we hope to see you at a tournament again real soon.
Thanks, guys. Thanks so much for having me, and have a great day, everyone. Bye-bye.
Have a great day.
Bye. All right, ladies and gentlemen, we're going to move now into our heralded fan segment of the afternoon. We have one lucky fan who is going to be calling in, and that is going to be someone by the name of Jake from We the Fans. He considers himself a young sports writer, and Jake is going to be tuning in with a hot sports take. So let's get Jake on the line.
Hey, Matt.
Hey, Jake, it's Matthew and Dan from outside the studio. We hear you have a hot take for us.
Oh, yeah. Yes, I do. And starting it right off, I think the NBA referees need to be held more accountable for some very errant ejections they've been making the last couple of weeks, one being J.J. Redick and the next one being Devin Booker when they're just passing the ball back to them. I mean, that's ridiculous. As a fan, if I'm sitting at the game, I just paid good money to see Devin Booker, and he gets tossed for tossing the ball back to the ref. That's garbage. I mean, I don't want to see that. The refs are there for three reasons, in my opinion, right? Keep the game moving, keep the game fair, keep the players safe, not to get their emotions involved into refereeing a game.
And there is, I completely agree with you. So just to give our listeners a little bit of a background, basically, the other night, Devin Booker got called for a foul, and when he complained slightly, and then he tossed back the ball. He did a quote-unquote aggressive bounce pass to the referee, and really there's no such thing as an aggressive bounce pass to a referee. This was a situation of pride. This was a situation where the referees let their emotions get in the way, and I understand it. The game has to be preserved. The respect for the referees has to be preserved. But what you're seeing in a game like basketball is you're seeing a lot of the referees taking over. You're seeing the referees, it's almost like they're promoting themselves and they're making the games about them, and I'm sure that's how you feel as well.
Yeah, you know, in some way you are absolutely right. I mean, look, if my favorite player is there and he's really acting out and he's warranting behavior that does warrant an ejection, fine, so be it. But I didn't see anything in J.J. Redick or Devin Booker passing the ball back to a referee, having them tossed from a game. You know, the refs can get together and say, you know, maybe because the refs didn't see it, the refs can get together and say, hey, what happened there? Why did I get hit with the basketball? Talk it over. too emotional, too emotional.
And I think one of the issues that happens in basketball is the fouls are can be so judgment based. I mean, and I think that's the issue that the referees are concerned about is they're thinking, well, if we don't preserve the respect, they can you can argue about every call in the NBA just because there's a lot of contact, there's a lot of situations where things are close and on the margins. But that isn't an excuse to let your pride get the best of you. And we're seeing that with these two plays that have happened recently. There was a play with Cousins, with Boogie Cousins, like not that long ago, where there was a similar type of situation. And it's just, I think the best way is to have more of a strict guideline on what gets you tossed. And what actually to give more guidance to the referees so that they can't use their judgment in that way, they can't overly use their discretion, and they have to do by the book.
That's a great point. You know, you don't think of it, but that's a great point. There should be some sort of some ejection guidelines. I like that idea.
Well, thank you so much for sharing, Jake. Ladies and gentlemen, that is Jake from Brooklyn, and we'll hopefully be hearing from him again soon as he's a loyal listener.
Thanks.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, we are entering into our final 2 minutes with you. It's been a terrific show, as always, and we would like to first say thank you to King Carlo and to Jake from Brooklyn, as well as to all of our loyal listeners who we polled at the top of the show for our hot take about the sport's most memorable and exciting plays. We will have, unfortunately, be out of time in just a minute. So, ladies and gentlemen, if you missed our live show, you can catch the recording on NewYorkExtra.com, on Spotify, on Podomatic, iTunes and Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, and please tune back in next Friday, March 12th at 4 p.m. Eastern Time, for more hot and cold sports takes. Once again, I'm Matthew Blittner. To my left, as always, is co-host Daniel Green, saying thank you for tuning in, and we have a lot of wonderful sports things coming up in the pipeline as spring training, baseball season, hockey playoffs, basketball playoffs, football calendar year starting, you name it, there's going to be a lot going on, and we're going to cover it all here on Outside the Studio. So please, if you enjoy our theme song, written by Jessica Page DeMary, whose full works are accessible online at jzcompositions.com, make sure to check it out, and we'll see you next time on Outside the Studio.